Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, Saved by Hope. Pope Benedict's new encyclical, Spe Salvi, is released here in the Vatican. We take a look at what hope means for Christians and why the Pope felt it was such an important theme. Reaction to Pope Benedict's invitation to Muslim intellectuals to come to the Vatican to talk about furthering dialogue between Christians and Muslims, and an exclusive interview with Israel's ambassador to the Holy See after the Annapolis Peace Summit, prospects for new dialogue with Syria, and will Lebanon soon have a new president? We talk to one expert who's concerned if the political vacuum continues. Saved by Hope, or in Latin, Spe Salvi. That's the title of Pope Benedict XVI's second encyclical letter released in the Vatican Friday. Lydia O'Kane was at the press conference Friday morning. She filed this report.
Much of the document was written in the tranquil setting of the Roman hills of Castel Gandolfo, where the Pope spent a large part of his summer vacation. The encyclical is divided into sections where Pope Benedict poses a number of questions. The first part deals with faith and hope and the concept of them in the New Testament and early church. The next part of the document focuses on eternal life, with the Pope asking the question, "What is it?" The following sections go on to discuss the transformation of Christian hope in the modern age and the true shape of Christian hope. Cardinal Albert Van Hoy, Professor Emeritus of the Pontifical Biblical Institute, presented the encyclical on Friday and spoke about what is at the core of the letter.
The central message is the very union of hope and love. The Pope speaks very often of love in relationship with hope, and that is very important, because love gave to the hope real dimension. A hope which is united with love cannot be an individual hope. The Pope also insists on the consolatio, that is suffering with those who suffer. It is a necessity for the Christian hope to be ready to partake the suffering of others.
Well, as we heard, the Pope took St. Paul's letter to the Romans as inspiration for the theme, "For in hope we have been saved." Susie Hodges spoke to Father Richard Taylor, Professor of Scriptures at the Pontifical Angelicum University here in Rome, about the significance of such hope for Christians.
I think, for instance, that hope itself is a major carrier of theological meaning, because it covers the whole of the expectation of the Old Testament and the realization of those expectations in the New Testament, and the mission of the Church to carry on what has been given in the actual life, death, and resurrection of Christ. So hope is both realized and to be realized, and on a grand scale, and on a personal scale.
Presumably it's no coincidence that this encyclical is coming out as the Church prepares for the year of St. Paul the Apostle.
Well, since he has quoted chapter 8 of the Epistle to the Romans, that can hardly be an accidental citation. It must be a major commitment. So that it will have something to do with what salvation means on a universal scale, I would say, there's no question about it.
Now, Pope Benedict has spoken about the importance of the virtue of hope on many occasions during his pontificate, hasn't he?
He has, yes. I mean, you've probably heard him say on several occasions, for instance, "Do not be afraid of death," which is very, very unusual to have somebody who is in the prime of life, even though he is of advanced age, encouraging people simply not to be afraid at the prospect of death. So that is on the personal level. But the idea of what hope implies as a major social reality, that has occupied him a lot over the years.
Pope Benedict's first encyclical, as we all know, was Deus Caritas Est, or God is Love, and that focused on love as well as the role of charity. Do you see any pattern in the subject of these encyclicals? First, we have one dealing with charity, now hope.
We're only dealing with two, I obviously accept the fact that it would be difficult to set as a pattern in them, apart from the fact that faith, hope and charity are the three theological virtues and the moral virtues. So the first encyclical was of foundational importance because it described the nature of God and the nature of God as love. And the fact is that God is experienced as love as well as described as love. So absolutely, as I say, foundational. Now comes hope. And the idea of hope, of course, is you can't say God is hope. You can say he's the ground of hope. But when you are talking about what this means in the Christian life, it is clearly the content of hope, of what salvation is, and the commitment to it with the expectation of its realization. So in that sense, yes, we love and we hope.
And when we talk about the hope offered by Christianity, how do you think that can be best summarised?
Well, it goes in certainly three ways. In other words, who is Jesus? What does it mean to encounter the eternal God in Jesus Christ, the historical figure? And what Jesus did and what he said involves, obviously, a major commitment in the way of faith and love, but also the idea of an afterlife as well as a present life. So it isn't just a question of be cheerful because you'll go to heaven when you're dead. It is a fact of bringing about the realities of the kingdom of God in this world as preparatory to the next world. So therefore, it is a major social commitment as well as, shall we say, a personal and ecclesial commitment.
Are there any other encyclicals in the pipeline that you know about?
He has promised another encyclical, but I can't name it. In other words, I simply don't know. It would be silly of me to guess at what it is. But obviously you would think that if it's in the backward sequence, it's got love, hope and faith. So let's see whether he'll give one on faith.
The Pope's first encyclical on love, it got a major, very positive reception, you know, even from non-Catholics. What do you think could be the reaction to this second encyclical?
It will go, I'm absolutely sure, in the same direction, because when he talked about love, he talked about the fundamental nature of a human being. We're made for love. And when you therefore do an existential inquiry into the nature of human beings, we live off hope. So the idea being that it's a fundamental part of our lives. Now, when you look at our world out there, which is looking for reasons to think that hope is not a delusion, he will be easily able to point up the fact that an enormous amount has been written on hope. So, for instance, Ernest Bloch, Das Prinzip Hoffnung, the principle of hope, was generative of a lot of Catholic writing like Moltmann on the nature, the theology of hope. Now, Professor Ratzinger in those days was involved in all of that. And when he knows French very well, one of the people involved in the philosophy of hope is Gabriel Marcel, Homo Viator. When you look at Newman, and he obviously is a great admirer of Newman, and Newman gives, in essence, the true happiness of man is not to know, to affect, or pursue, but to love, to hope, to joy, to admire, to revere, to adore. And when, again, as I say, the Pope knows the French situation very well, and I'm conscious, for instance, of Charles Péguy. La foi que j'aime le mieux, dit Dieu, c'est l'espérance. The faith that God's love best is hope. So what I'm saying is, it's a carrier of the meaning of salvation at a great number of levels, so that it obviously is involved in the socio-economic field as well as the personal existential field. And since this is joining the Old Testament expectation and the New Testament fulfillment, it's the unity of the Bible playing in the tradition of the Church. It's a major engagement.
That was Father Richard Taylor, a professor of scriptures at the Pontifical Angelicum University here in Rome. We'll be speaking on Saturday's program to a moral theologian for some more analysis on the encyclical, so do tune in again for that. Pope Benedict has written a letter to Muslim scholars inviting them to the Vatican to discuss ways to further Christian-Muslim dialogue. The letter, dated November 19th, but released just late Thursday by the Vatican, was in response to a message sent to Christian leaders last month by 138 Muslim intellectuals. Philippa Hitchin has more on that.
The letter is addressed to Jordanian Prince Ghazi bin Mohammed bin Talal and signed by Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone. It expresses the Pope's deep appreciation for the positive spirit which inspired the text from Muslim scholars and its call for a common commitment to promoting peace in the world. The Pope's letter states that while it's important not to ignore or downplay the differences between Christians and Muslims, we can and therefore should look to what unites us, namely belief in the one God. But most importantly, it concludes with an invitation to the Jordanian prince and to a select group of the Muslim signatories to come to the Vatican. Dr. Aref Ali Nayed, director of the Royal Islamic Strategic Studies Center in Amman and one of the signatories to the original letter, welcomes the Vatican's response. He says it continues the spirit of dialogue born of the Second Vatican Council's document, Nostra Aetate.
It is through such good news that people build up hope and a new atmosphere of peacemaking and conflict resolution is developed. And that is why it was important for the Vatican to give a positive response. It means that the Vatican is committed to the Nostra Aetate spirit. So we will see how things will develop. It will take time, and there will be a period of getting to know each other again, in a sense. But this is an important step that we do welcome.
Also in the letter, Pope Benedict proposes setting up working meetings between the Muslim scholars and Vatican organizations, such as the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, the Pontifical Gregorian University, and the Pontifical Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies, or PISAI. Father Etienne Renaud is Director of Studies at PISAI. He says this invitation to Muslim scholars is an important step in the new phase of the dialogue.
In practical terms, I think, they will most probably accept it, and they will come to Rome, a kind of delegation. They will certainly meet His Holiness, and there will be a kind of working session with some institute of Rome, say the PISAI and maybe the Gregoriana. And I think it is good if we base ourselves on that common start, which was expressed in their letter.
Father Etienne Renaud, Director of Studies at the Pontifical Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies. I'm Philippa Hitchin.
And we'll have more reaction to the Pope's letter to Muslims in the coming broadcasts, so do look out for those next week. Two polls in Israel this week show that fewer than one out of five Israelis believe the Mideast Peace Conference in the U.S. state of Maryland was a success, and more than 80% of the public think Israeli and Palestinian leaders will not be able to reach a final agreement by the end of next year. Well, I sat down for a talk with Israel's ambassador to the Holy See, Oded Ben-Hur, and asked him why is there so much pessimism over the results of the Annapolis summit, and should people be more hopeful that peace can and will be achieved sooner than later?
There's another factor that one should bear in mind, and it's a figure which is constant there for a long, long time. 70% at any given time, polls taken in Israel showed that 70% of the population is for a solution in the body of two states for two peoples. Therefore, two states for two peoples means withdrawal from the territories. So you have a solid majority that has been constant of people that the moment of truth comes will support such a move. This is the reason, actually, why we came to Annapolis, because if there were only bad sentiments and suspicions and lack of credibility to what we were doing, then we wouldn't be there. Annapolis, will it or not, has been already a success, just for the simple fact that so many Arab countries have joined hands in declaring beforehand and then joining us at the conference in Washington, given a chance to a true, courageous, painful, maybe, effort on both sides to really put an end to this long tragedy called the Middle East conflict. We are confident. We're confident because I would also like to draw the attention of your listeners to the fact that not always what you hear is what you get. In other words, there are things behind the scene. Things that you don't know. People are talking. People keep meeting with each other behind closed doors, in Europe, elsewhere. So we should be more trusting. We should be more confident and give it some more time. This is a newly born baby. We have to teach him or her how to walk. And we should only express support and goodwill. Otherwise, it will fail.
What does your government think about the presence of Syria at the last minute in those talks in Annapolis? And is Israel ready for peace talks with Syria?
Israel not only is ready for peace talks with Syria, but we have been for a long time. Negotiations, and as you may know, took place between old governments already on in the period of Hafez al-Assad, the president's father, with various prime ministers of Israel. We reached some agreements, some understandings. Too bad it never materialized until this very date. But the major ideas are there. We know what is at stake. We know basically what it should look like. We know what both sides are demanding. And all it takes now is the courage to put it in writing, to meet and be willing to dive into this pool, so to speak, and conclude these things. I believe that, as our prime minister said, as our government reiterated time and again, that when we see this move on behalf of the Arab world and the Arab League, this is why we're so happy that the Arab League agreed as such to come to the conference, then there will be negotiations with Syria. As I said, contacts are being done all the time, and I suggest that we should just wait and see.
You used a very important word. You said courage. Both sides need to have the courage to go through with this peace. It's something that Pope Benedict himself said right before the meetings in Annapolis. He said, "We hope that the delegates will have the wisdom and the courage to truly search for peace." I mean, it's going to require sacrifice on all sides, Palestinians, Syrians, Lebanese, Israelis. What sacrifices is Israel prepared to make?
Yes, I fully agree with the appeal that the Pope made in last Angelus last Sunday. But it is enough to see that throughout all our years of independence, 60 years, we have been living in a state of emergency, which probably, almost surely, is not the case with any of the Arab countries around us. Look what we're talking about. We are talking about the creation of a Palestinian state, a future state, right out loud, overtly, without hiding it, without trying to blur the vision. But basically, Israel is taking risks that the Arab countries don't. There is no Arab country whose existence is menaced, is threatened, which is the case with us.
You mentioned the settlements and also the return of the Palestinian refugees. How is Israel prepared to deal with those issues?
Well, sacrifices, first of, as far as the Israeli internal society is concerned, there are people, I will not lie to you, there are people in Israel who think that the area belongs to us, and that we are compromising. It's a sacrifice. The Judea-Samaria was Jewish thousands of years ago. These are places that are mentioned in the Bible. Every page that you turn in the Old Testament, you find the assurance that it was ours. So this is one sacrifice. Another is that we are shrinking our existence, our geographical existence over there, to a width along the area of the Sharon, the center of Israel, where one-third of the population of Israel is located. We are willing to withdraw now to the pre-67 lines, and I don't know how many of your listeners know that the width of that country will be 15 kilometers, 9 miles. It is less than the distance between JFK and Manhattan. We're talking about absurd figures. This is a major risk. And today, with terrorism, with the highly sophisticated methods of destruction, this is a major risk. Coming down from the Golan Heights, or this is why we're insisting on demilitarizing it rather than have the Syrians sit on the Israeli northern border, the risks are many. But the desire is there, and the necessity to overcome these fears and take risks is very much there. I believe that the overwhelming majority in Israel will prevail, and this is why I'm making an appeal to all the people that are listening to us to take a deep breath, trust the people that are negotiating on both sides and both parties, and just wait and see.
In these polls that I mentioned before, it seems that about 70% of Israelis are against the idea of surrendering the Golan Heights, giving it back to Syria.
I don't think that you can take a poll without explaining to the people what the modalities are. The very mere philosophical idea of whether or not we should be present at the Golan Heights, yeah, that I can understand. But if they can offer us, with a world guarantee, international community guarantee, that coming down from the Golan Heights and have this area demilitarized, or giving other guarantees that we will have some sort of a beginning of a peace, I think that you will find that the 70% will not be prevalent anymore.
Do you see something like the southern Lebanon situation with UNIFIL there in the Golan Heights as a possibility then?
What, there will be a UNIFIL in the Golan Heights? Well, there used to be some kind of forces, it's called the UNSO, if I remember correctly, also in the Golan Heights. The fact that we don't need it anymore, and it's not there anymore, goes to show that, first of all, by the way, the border between Syria and Israel has been quiet for quite a few years, which goes to show that things are possible. I don't know, again, the ideas are many, and people keep meeting, discussing many, many ways out. What we know is that it is high time now that we use this window of opportunity, and that all populations are ready now for sacrifices.
Lebanon was also represented in Annapolis this week, though the country was still without a president to replace President Amin Lahoud, whose mandate ended last week. The majority government of Prime Minister Fouad Siniora has for months been locked in a battle with opposition groups led by Hezbollah over who should become the nation's new president, a post constitutionally reserved for a Christian Maronite. A parliamentary vote on the presidency, scheduled for Friday, was postponed for the sixth time. But lawmakers and opposition leaders appear closer now to agreeing on a consensus candidate, Army Chief Michel Sleiman. In view of a new parliamentary vote scheduled for next week, they are now examining an amendment to the country's constitution to allow Sleiman to take up the post.
The Lebanese population has been tormented for so many years, and the fact that they had been under such foreign influences and internal ones, talking about the fact that Hezbollah actually is ruling the southern part of Lebanon. So I think that it's high time that we supported the Lebanese people, that the world of international community supported the Lebanon in order to arrive at a peaceful solution. Look what's happening now with the election of the president. It's an ongoing torment, and I think it's high time that they did elect a president in order to secure the continuity, to secure the same infrastructure of Lebanese, the fiber of the Lebanese social makeup remains the same. In other words, third Sunni, third Shiite, and third Christian. We've been hearing about the possibility. We heard about a possibility that it will be Michel Sleiman, the head of the military, the chief of staff. And then the Christians have been willing to change, to amend the constitution for that. Remains to be seen. But as long as there are no riots in Lebanon, as long as it's done in a peaceful way, then we should give it a chance, because there's no question about it. Lebanon or Lebanese president has to be elected by the Lebanese people. So any kind of a solution imposed by the West or anybody else is bound to fail, I believe, because they will have to be the ones who decide about the future of Lebanon, the Lebanese themselves.
Israeli ambassador to the Holy See, Oded Ben-Hur. Well, some in Lebanon have expressed concern that if the presidency were not filled soon, people might get accustomed to being without a president. I asked the director of the Montreal-based Middle East Observatory, Tony Ad, what would such a vacuum mean for the Christian community in Lebanon?
I do agree with this analysis. The very fact of not electing a new president soon would have very negative consequences. First, people would get used to the presidential vacuum, and this would affect the very essence, the very philosophy of the political system in Lebanon, which is based on power sharing between the communities, religious communities in Lebanon. So the Christians would feel that they are not anymore represented, and they are not assuming the role that they should in the political system per se. The other very negative, more negative consequence is about the eventuality of violence in the streets, demonstrations, and we've been seeing this before. I mean, it happened on the 23rd and 25th of last January, when demonstrations turned out to become violences in the streets. So this is a very dangerous, or could be a very dangerous situation.
Now, Pope John Paul lived through Lebanon's worst years, the civil war, the 1980s. There was a situation similar to what we're seeing now in Lebanon, with a vacuum in the government of the presidency. But Pope John Paul wanted to hold up Lebanon as a message. In fact, he called it a message of pluralism and of coexistence for the entire Middle East. Is that message still valid today?
Very good question. If a solution is not reached within a very reasonable framework, this message could be lost. And this is very serious, this is very dangerous, and this is what it's about, really, I mean, when it comes to the actual deadlock in Lebanon.
Is Lebanon too pluralistic? Pope John Paul called it a pluralistic society, but is Lebanon perhaps too pluralistic in the sense that all the different communities are very individualistic? They're looking, it seems to me, that they're looking more towards their individual desires and hopes for Lebanon, but not necessarily for the common good, for the national good. Am I wrong in interpreting it that way?
Not really. I mean, indeed, the Lebanese society is a very pluralistic one. But as I see things, the problem is, one of the major problems is about the political system that we have in Lebanon. There is a gap between the political system and the social reality. The social reality is a very pluralistic one, as you put it, but the political system is a very centralized one. So there is a gap. And for me, until we reach some middle point between those two realities, the constitutional one, the political constitutional one, and the social cultural one, we would still have problems in Lebanon.
One of the ideas that has been tossed around is changing Lebanon's constitution to eliminate the confessional division of political power, or to change it so that it's not based on religion. The president doesn't necessarily have to be a Christian Maronite. The prime minister doesn't necessarily have to be a Sunni Muslim, and the Speaker of the House doesn't necessarily have to be a Shiite. Is that a good or a bad proposal?
I think that we should think to go the other way, not to deconfessionalize the system, but to first to admit the very pluralistic reality of the society, and then to act upon this. So, as I said before, we have to reach a political formula that recognizes this very multicultural and pluralistic aspect of the Lebanese society, not the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Where does the electoral reform laws come into play here? I know that there was quite a lot of discussion back in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. The electoral law was considered unfair by a lot of Christian and Muslim groups.
This is one of the proposals, of the ideas that we were debating. But electoral reform are much needed in Lebanon, but it's a very immediate measure. What I would like to focus more on is the very strategic proposal and a more long-term vision, which is about conciliating the political system and the social and cultural reality in Lebanon. But yes, indeed, the electoral system, electoral law in Lebanon must be reviewed, must be reformed. And this is a continuous debate in Lebanon.
One perspective offered there by the director of the Montreal-based Middle East Observatory, Tony Ad. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.